Ignition sequence start.
See, Elijah Wan has David Robinson just bamboozled.
Kelly out of the corner for three.
Don't ever underestimate the heart of a champion.
The Houston Rockets select Yao Ming.
McGrady at the buzzer. Yes!
Paul touches it.
The doctor
goes to Hart. On Thompson steps right, shoots for the win. A three. He got it.
I know what we need to do. I know exactly what we need to do.
Russell Westbrook.
James Harden.
I know what's at stake.
It's going to be scary.
Not for us.
What's up, everybody, and welcome to another episode of Locked On Rockets, your daily podcast home for everything Houston Rockets basketball. I am your host, Jackson Gatlin, at JT Gatlin on Twitter, producer with Sports Talk 790, the team's official radio flagship here in Houston. Now, it's been a minute since we've actually gotten a chance to talk because we had a guest who was supposed to be on for a Thursday night recording of this pod and then, you know, to air for the Friday show, and regrettably that fell through at the last moment. It's kind of hard to reschedule something like that, so we just didn't have a podcast Friday, and I do apologize about that. I did graduate Friday, so that kind of played a part in not being able to reschedule something so last minute. So the last time we spoke, I was not a graduate of the University of Houston, and now I am, so that's kind of cool. But in Rockets news, there's been a lot going on since the last time we spoke. We have the Orlando Magic game, in which the Rockets absolutely hammered the, at the time, eighth-ranked defense in the league in the Orlando Magic, 130-107. And then, regrettably, the following evening, the Rockets were the 107, with the Pistons being 115 in the second night of a back-to-back, the loss at home against the Pistons. So, kind of a mixed bag there. You're impressed by the Orlando Magic game. James Harden drops in another 50-point game. Westbrook had a phenomenal all-around game, 9 of 18 shooting, 23 points, looked really good, had a couple dunks in transition. He's looking more explosive, and we'll get more on that in just a little bit. And then in addition to those two games, which we'll be talking about, we've also got the two of the most plugged-in insiders across the entire NBA in Zach Lowe and Adrian Wojnarowski, who had a discussion yesterday evening being Sunday evening, and I don't want to say it was their podcast, I want to say it was on ESPN, and there was somebody who live tweeted the whole thing. I didn't get a chance to actually watch it live, but there were a couple tidbits concerning the Houston Rockets that I found interesting, so we'll touch base on that in segment three, as well as a couple trade rumors and ideas, kind of revisiting the Robert Covington situation, the Andre Iguodala situation, of which Zach Lowe and Adrian Wojnarowski did touch base on. So for two of the most plugged-in guys across the entire NBA, the news that they're dropping about the Rockets, while you take everything with a grain of salt until something actually happens, I'm going to trust that these guys are pretty plugged in and kind of know what they're talking about for the most part. But first, let's circle back around, and we'll start with the Magic game from Friday night. Overall, that game, first off, Evan Fournier goes off against the Rockets every single time they play. He is a certified Rockets killer. I don't know what it is about him, but he goes off every time that they play. They didn't win the game, thank goodness. But still, Fournier with 27 points, 6 of 11 shooting from behind the arc, 10 of 18 overall. He just, for whatever reason, hates the Houston Rockets. And every time that they play, it feels like he has a monster night. Didn't have quite as much of a monster night as James Harden, though, who doubled Fournier's point total. So Harden had another 50-point game, 54 points, 5 rebounds, 7 assists, 2 steals, 3 blocks, 10 of 15. Hit 10 threes again. 19 of 31 overall, 6 of 6 from the charity stripe. James Harden just putting in another monster performance, a plus 21 in 36 minutes played. This was a phenomenal outing from James Harden. And at this point, you know, we look at James, and when he has a 50-point game, we're amazed again. When he has a 40-point game, we say, okay, yeah, this is about par for the course. And then anything south of 40, 39 and below, we're just like, what's wrong with him? Is he okay? Is he not feeling well? Did he not shoot well? Which is absurd to think about, because some people, and they say it on the broadcast all the time, we talk about it all the time, some people's career highs aren't even in the 30s. There are NBA players who have played their, who have played an entire 10 or 15 year career, and their career high point total isn't even in the 30s. And yet James Harden eclipses that every single evening, it feels like, and to the point where we expect something more than that. We are so spoiled by the greatness that is James Harden that when he puts in a 30-point performance, we wonder what's wrong with him, which is very strange to think about. In addition to James, Westbrook looked phenomenal, and I spoke about this a little bit during the game on Twitter, but I think that collectively, we expected maybe a little bit too much of Westbrook right out of the gate, and these star pairings never really work out that way. It felt a little bit different when Chris Paul started here in Houston because, again, Chris Paul has better tools to be just essentially a spot-up shooter next to James Harden, as James Harden was running things when they were originally meshing together, whereas Westbrook, unfortunately, and even D'Antoni has remarked on this, that you know earlier this season before things got started with James Harden and Russell Westbrook on the court together, D'Antoni was basically saying, look, Westbrook's going to do a lot of standing around, and for the most part, that stayed true. James has moved a little bit more off-ball than he has in the past, especially when Westbrook's the one handling it. But for the most part, Westbrook still just kind of, he does his thing, he stands around. He doesn't really move off-ball that well. We've seen him have some cuts here and there, and mainly off of passes from James, where he's able to move off-ball and get a better look than what would be just a pass to Westbrook sitting at the three-point line for either a clunker of a three or then another dribble penetration action in the offense. So Westbrook had a great game because it looks like his explosiveness is finally returning, and I think that's because we expected a little bit too much from him at the start of the season. We expected him to come to Houston and be in this MVP type form that we kind of know about him from the 16-17 season. We expected that version of Westbrook. We expected this powerhouse, one man army in transition, dunking machine, freak athlete Westbrook right out of the gate. And we didn't get that. And I think a big part of that was the offseason knee scope, the fact that he wasn't physically active all summer, and then he also had the dislocated fingers that he's been battling, which the tape recently came off of those, and basically the lineup as far as how the dates look from when he took the tape off his fingers, as well as I guess that's kind of coinciding with maybe his knee feeling a little bit better, or just getting his legs underneath him better. He's been playing some great basketball. He's been playing the way that Rockets fans had hoped he would play right out of the gate. And in addition to my remarks about the offseason knee scope affecting his physical performance, I think there's that kind of lends itself to the fact that Westbrook also was making worse decisions than he normally would. Now, let's face it, Westbrook is not the best decision maker. His basketball IQ is not the best on the court. You can live with that. There are players that, you know, haven't had supreme basketball IQs like Chris Paul who have still won championships, who have still competed at a high level. But with Westbrook, I think that the fact that he is a player who relies so much on his athleticism and his ability to drive and get to the basket at will against his opponents, for a guy like that who maybe wasn't able to do that as consistently as he would have liked to start the season, we're finally seeing the Westbrook that can explode and get past anybody. We're seeing a bit of a tighter handle when he's dribbling the ball, thanks to the tape coming off his hand. And I think that will lend itself to Westbrook's decision-making getting better. Because think about it, if you're a basketball player and you're consistently used to doing or to playing in a certain way or playing in a certain environment or playing with a certain style, and suddenly you are physically limited and you can't play that way anymore, of course that's going to impact your decision-making. Think about a guy, I'll use Gordon Hayward as an example. Gordon Hayward, after his horrific injury, when he, you know, went through the whole year-long rehab and then comes back. Gordon Hayward looked like a shell of his former self, more than likely because not only was he still battling that injury, but he was also playing much more conservatively than he used to. Anybody who's ever had an injury anywhere in any sport understands that when you first ease your way back, you're going to play a little bit more conservatively. And while it wasn't an injury in the offseason for Westbrook and it was just a scope, that has similar effects to an actual injury. So Westbrook probably came into the season maybe a little bit more out of shape than used to, than he's used to being, because he didn't get to be physically active all summer. He didn't get to play basketball all summer. And he's now, just now, kind of working his way into where he's comfortable being. And I think that's a huge aspect of his game that we kind of didn't really think about coming into the season. And we expected this dynamic duo between Harden and Westbrook to mesh right away. And it just, it didn't at times, and at other times it looked really good. But I think now we're finally getting to the point where Westbrook is hopefully physically at a place where he can be this version of Westbrook consistently, to quote Clyde, night in and night out. And that's going to make the Rockets really, really tough. And it's apparent that they were sorely missing Westbrook in the Pistons game. And we'll get more on that in just a second. But first, a quick word from our friends over at Casper. The original Casper mattress combines multiple supportive memory foams for a quality sleep surface with the right amounts of both sink and bounce. You can get $100 towards select mattresses by visiting Casper.com and using code LOCKEDONNBA at checkout. Terms and conditions apply. And if you can't visit Casper right now, you can find this and all other offers from Locked On sponsors at LockedOnPodcast.com/offers. All right, and we are back in here at Locked On Rockets, your daily podcast home for everything Houston Rockets basketball. Now, after kind of discussing that Magic game, you know, and we had good games. Ben McLemore off the bench, 18 points, killed it from the three-point line, 6 of 7 shooting. The rest of the team played really well. Austin Rivers got some limited minutes. Gary Clark got some limited minutes. Gary Clark had an overall pretty solid game, 9 points, 2 of 5 shooting from behind the stripe, or behind the three-point line, I should say, 3 rebounds, an assist, he had a block. D'Antoni really spread the minutes around to the rest of the crew that night. Cephalosha got 4, Hartenstein got 7, Clemens got 3. Part of that was because the Rockets had a healthy lead down the stretch, and so those guys were able to get a little bit of burn. But then you come back to the Pistons game, where the Rockets basically ran an 8-man, not basically, they did run an 8-man rotation. And they ran a heavy starters minutes 8-man rotation because your bench consisted of Gary Clark, Chris Clemens, and Austin Rivers. And Rivers was the high minute man off the bench with 28 minutes. Clemens got 16, Rivers got 14. Your starters, PJ hit 41, D House hit 34, Capella hit 35, Harden at 38, Ben McLemore at 33. And so this is something that we've become accustomed to with Mike D'Antoni, is the Rockets starters and the Rockets players just getting these absurd minute totals. And I kind of understand you don't have Russell Westbrook in this game, you're missing Tyson Chandler, but for a game in the middle of December, a game that you regrettably wound up losing, it just feels really bad to burn this many minutes into your starters and then not come away with the W. It feels kind of like the Spurs double overtime, where you kind of lose on two fronts. You lose on the front that, yeah, you lost the game, and then on top of that, you lose because then you're racking up these minutes on your players for what seems to be no reason. There were people on Twitter calling for James Harden to just be sat at the start of the fourth quarter and to just not play him the rest of the game because it looked like the game was getting out of hand, and it really was. The Rockets were unable to get stops down the stretch, and Derrick Rose, credit to him, looked phenomenal. He was picking apart the Rockets' defense like it didn't even exist. And I know that the Rockets' defense isn't anything to write home about at this point in the season, but for a guy to come in off the bench and drop in not just 20 points, but to have 12 dimes off the bench. And down the stretch, Derrick Rose was actually carving up the defense. It's not like the Rockets were, you know, it wasn't for lack of effort. It was just Derrick Rose was making some phenomenal passes down the stretch. I think he had a no-look bounce pass to one of the Pistons' bigs down the stretch that was just, you had to just sit there and appreciate it because it was great basketball being played. Now, obviously, then you look back at the scoreboard as a Rockets fan, and you're like, well, why is this great basketball being played against us right now? It was frustrating. And in a game where Blake Griffin played for the first half, played 15 minutes, did not look good at all, missed all seven of his shots, missed all three of his threes. He only had 2 points. Blake Griffin, you know, looking like that knee injury is very much hampering him. And then no Andre Drummond because he had an allergic reaction to an avocado in Mexico City while they were down there for the NBA Mexico games. So basically you're playing an undermanned Detroit Pistons team and you're still not able to come away with the win. It's a bit concerning. The Rockets' inability to put away this team while they're missing arguably their two best players. You can maybe make an argument for Derrick Rose over Blake Griffin right now, just because Blake's just been absolutely hampered by that injury. But even the Rockets missing Russell Westbrook, and they've been missing Eric Gordon, so that's not really an excuse at this point. You need to expect more out of the rest of the team. Ben McLemore didn't perform that great. It was just 1 of 4 from behind the arc. PJ Tucker, 1 of 7. Daniel House, 1 of 3. Gary Clark, 0 of 3. Austin Rivers, 1 of 4. Really, and James, 4 of 13. So overall, the team did not have a great night shooting-wise. Finished 28%, 29% basically from behind the arc, 13 of 45. Chris Clemens was the only one that tore it up. He was 5 of 11, 17 points off the bench. But really, even though the shooting struggles were there, it wasn't offensively that this team was struggling. It really felt like defensively the Pistons were getting absolutely whatever they wanted. And in the earlier parts of the game, it seemed like there were just some defensive breakdowns where Luke Kennard or Tony Snell got wide open looks from behind the arc. Snell finished 3 of 6, Kennard 4 of 7 from behind the arc. And a part of this game that I'm not usually a big fan of NBA conspiracy theories, but it really felt like the Rockets got an abysmal amount of calls for the team that leads the league in free throw attempts and free throw makes, in large part due to James Harden, obviously. But it really felt like there was a disproportionate number of calls in this game. Now, you look at the end box score, and the Pistons had 25 free throw attempts. They went 21 of 25. The Rockets had 18, where they shot 12 of 18. So that's not a huge discrepancy, but not just in the free throw shooting. It really felt like there were more than a handful of times where calls were just not being made, where there was contact, this is on both sides of the ball. This is not just a Rockets thing. This was a Pistons thing. And at the end of the day, all I usually preach about the referees is I just want consistency with the refs. I want the refs to be the same from one game to the next. I really hate that there's this drop-off in the playoffs where there's this understanding that, yep, in the playoffs, the refs just kind of swallow their whistles and, you know, fouls get harder and they kind of let the players play a little bit. Why? Why would you suddenly change the rules going from the regular season into the playoffs? It's mind-boggling to me. But in this game, it really felt like the refs were not blowing the whistle hardly at all. And I think that an understated part of the protests that the Rockets filed about the Spurs game is that it's not a great look for the Rockets. And past that, it has repercussions. And the NBA is never going to come out and say, yeah, we are officiating the Rockets differently because they protested the Spurs game and because they shined? We're going to go with shone. I don't know if that's right. Basically, they put a spotlight on the abysmal officiating job by the three refs in that game and made the NBA address it on such a large scale, on a big stage. And that has repercussions. Just like the Rockets coming out and leaking the referee disparity in the playoffs last season, talking about the calls that Golden State got versus the Rockets in the seven game series from the Western Conference Finals the year prior, all these things. These things have repercussions. And again, I'm not a huge fan of NBA conspiracies, but I think that maybe that might play a part. And maybe it's not even like, you know, Adam Silver's on the phone with the lead referee, the crew chief, every night, and he's like, yep, you know, don't give the Rockets any calls. I don't think it's something as abhorrent as that. I think it's something more along the lines of the referees themselves have an inherent bias. They're human beings. And if you've got somebody or an organization, a whole organization, that's calling you out saying you're doing poorly at your job, even if you are, you're going to feel some kind of way about that. And so the crew chief of the evening, Ed Malloy, has historically not been great to the Houston Rockets, not nearly on the level of Scott Foster or Tony Brothers, but he's not a referee whose name I enjoy seeing on the official report. And I'm not chalking this loss up to the referees, not one bit. The Rockets have lost this game all on their own, their inability to get stops, and just frankly, the energy just wasn't there from the get-go. This Rockets team, second night of a back-to-back, you just played in Orlando, had to fly overnight, get back to Houston. You're missing your second-best player in Russell Westbrook. And frankly, this Rockets team without Westbrook, and this was the similar case with Chris Paul in the games that he sat out, they looked like the Rockets team from the 16-17 season, where it was just James Harden, Patrick Beverley, and Eric Gordon were your guards. And regrettably, when James would sit with that team, you just kind of sat there and you just put your hands together and prayed a little bit that whatever lead that the Rockets had wouldn't suddenly disappear, and or you even were worried that you wouldn't make the hole that much bigger than it already was, because let's face it, the bench unit from that 16-17 team was not that great. Yes, that was the year Eric Gordon won his Sixth Man of the Year, but the way the offense is structured since Mike D'Antoni has come to Houston, it's not really a Mike D'Antoni offense, it's a James Harden offense, which is why at times Chris Paul looked out of place, or at times Russell Westbrook even looks out of place in this offense, is because this offense is centered around the fact that James Harden is the best isolation player in history, and he is a one-man wrecking crew on offense. So when James Harden sits, this offense looks a little flustered at times when you don't have a dominant ball handler who is comfortable creating not only a shot for himself or shots for other players. Chris Paul could do that. Westbrook can do it. Eric Gordon can do it a little bit. Austin Rivers can do it a little bit, which is why when those two guys are essentially running the offense when James sits, it doesn't look phenomenal. It looks like a team that wouldn't make the playoffs, honestly. And we saw a bunch of that in the Pistons game because Westbrook was sitting. Now, Austin Rivers did a decent job in his time running the offense. He, 14 points, 5 boards, 5 assists. Not a horrible game from Rivers, but just not what we're accustomed to from the bench unit minutes, of which in the last, 4 or 5 games, Westbrook has looked really great. He's looked completely different than the Westbrook that we started the season with. So I think that there was obviously a lot of defensive misgivings for this Pistons game, which led to the loss, the inability to get stops down the stretch, and really the inability to guard Derrick Rose. He carved up the defense. I mean, he was their closer, and not just scoring the ball, he was facilitating, he was getting others involved, and not being able to stop him down the stretch is basically what lost you this game. So we'll keep talking about, well, we won't keep talking about this game. We'll actually break into the Adrian Wojnarowski and Zach Lowe news that dropped, their kind of insider rumblings, as well as some other potential trade targets and stuff of that nature in just one moment. And here we are for our final segment at Locked On Rockets, your daily podcast home for everything Houston Rockets basketball, where we are going to be talking about Adrian Wojnarowski and Zach Lowe, two of the premier NBA insiders, consistently plugged into everything going on around the league, as well as a couple potential trade targets for the Rockets, just basically some off-court discussion for this final segment. Now, the first thing that I'm going to dive into is Woj basically said that Houston is giving up on versions of the 3- and 4-team trade deals that would allow them to acquire Andre Iguodala. So essentially that means no Andre Iguodala for the Houston Rockets. Because again, in order to match salaries to get Andre Iguodala over here, the Rockets would have to ship out 5 to 6 different guys. It would basically be Nene, Tyson Chandler, Gerald Green, who would have to agree to a trade. It would be some variation of that where you'd have to lump together 5 or 6 of your minimum deal guys in order to absorb the salary that is Andre Iguodala, and then you'd have to include a third team or even a fourth team to be able to take back some of that salary. So Andre Iguodala was a long shot, and it looks like that's probably not going to happen. If Woj says it, it's probably not going to happen. Now, some other guys that have been on the Rockets' radar a little bit that I think are still possible, Robert Covington is one. However, I believe that the Minnesota Timberwolves can garner more than just what would be the Rockets' late first-round pick in this upcoming draft, because that's basically the only thing that the Rockets have that I feel like the Timberwolves would be interested in. I mean, you can maybe make an argument that one of the young guys, whether it be Chris Clemens or Gary Clark or Isaiah Hartenstein. Also, look, I know that it might be heresy to suggest trading Gary Clark, but for Robert Covington, I'd do it. Anyways, so basically, you could make the argument that one of those young guys plus the first-round draft pick might be enough compensation, plus then you've got to match the salary, which lends itself its own set of problems, much similar to the Andre Iguodala situation, because I want to say Roko makes about $11.3 million or something around there, so you wouldn't have to package as many guys together to hit that salary mark, but you'd still have to package multiple guys, which then means Minnesota either has to waive guys to make roster spots, or you have to get a third team involved, things of that nature. So Roko is still very, very slim, because I think there's going to be another team looking to acquire him that may or may not have more to offer than the Houston Rockets do. Then we've got Markieff Morris, who just played against the Rockets on the Pistons, and he is a guy who is kind of in that in-betweener role, kind of a 3/4, could maybe play a small ball 5, can hit a three-point shot consistently, shooting over 40% from behind the arc. He's only making $3.2 million this year. And the unique thing is the Rockets have a trade exception from the Brandon Knight trade for $3.6 million. So they could easily just absorb Markieff Morris's salary, and they could send back the Pistons a second-round pick or a first-rounder or whatever compensation would be necessary, and you wouldn't even have to worry about, at that point, about matching contract salaries or doing anything of that nature. You wouldn't have to give anything up. Maybe you give up one of the, well, you can't give up one of the young guys, unfortunately. It's not how TPEs work. You can't pair them. You can't aggregate that salary with another player. So the Rockets could absorb him, but the Rockets are also sitting comfortably above the luxury tax threshold right now. And I think one element of any trades that the Rockets look at doing, for all of Daryl Morey's, we'll call them salary cap gymnastics that he's been able to do in previous years to avoid paying the luxury tax, I don't think he's going to be able to pull it off this year. It just doesn't look feasible to me. If, let me pull up Spotrac really quick. Where'd it go? Okay. So looking at the team overall, they are, what is it? They are $7.6 million over the luxury tax threshold as we speak. And so even if you dove in and you just started waiving guys, if you got rid of Nene, and this is just, I'm just talking about waiving guys, not even trading them for assets to get back. I'm talking about you just waive Nene, you waive Gary Clark, Isaiah Hartenstein. You basically, you knock out all the salary that you can, the salary that isn't necessary for this season, and you're still not going to get under the luxury tax threshold. It's just not going to happen. So I think this is going to be the season where we see Tillman actually pay the luxury tax. The only question is, how much more of it is he willing to pay if it means improving the roster? Because again, if you're able to just absorb Markieff Morris's contract using the TPE from Brandon Knight, that adds another $3.2 million to your payroll, which then gets compounded by the fact that you're paying the luxury tax, which right now, the Rockets' estimated luxury tax bill is $12 million. So that would jump up another considerable amount. So is Tillman willing to pay that money to give the Rockets their, essentially their ninth rotation guy that they sorely need? Ben McLemore has proven to be a bit better than I thought he was going to be. I had my reservations about him. I voiced them on here thinking that I didn't think he was going to make the cut. Not the cut to the original team, but I didn't see him with his very strange starting and bench splits. I didn't see any consistency there for him to find a spot on this roster. And he also wasn't what the Rockets needed. He's a 6'3 guard. He's not a wing. He doesn't provide that kind of lockdown wing defense that you'd like to pair up with PJ Tucker and Daniel House to kind of spell them and give them some time where you're not just sorely missing size when those two guys sit. So Ben McLemore didn't give you a lot of those things, so I didn't think he was going to make the cut. I still think the Rockets need a ninth guy past Ben McLemore. I don't think he's the ninth guy. And they sorely need, again, another wing slash forward type guy like House or like PJ Tucker to kind of fill in some of those gap minutes right there. Gary Clark may or may not be this guy. I kind of like Gary in the backup small ball five role. I think he's excelling in that role, especially when he gets to play alongside PJ Tucker. Our defense looks pretty solid when it's PJ and Gary Clark in there at the same time because they're taking in a lot of rebounds, they're switching well, and Gary is a great off-ball defender. But Morris would give you another guy like that. It's all about whether or not the Rockets are willing to absorb his salary and pay the extra money to do that. There are a couple other guys, and another one that is an interesting aspect would be, or an interesting possibility would be, Bertans from the Wizards. Davis Bertans is making just $7 million this year, so the Rockets could stack a few players and match that salary pretty easily. He's only signed for a one-year deal, and so he'd be a half-season rental. And for a team like the Rockets, who shoot as many three-pointers as they do, it has always confused me that they've never had a truly lights-out kind of three-point specialist. It feels like most teams have that one guy, and you just know you cannot leave him wide open. They have that one guy, and if you leave him open, he's going to drain every three ball that he touches. Bertans could be that guy. And for a half-season rental, not sure what the Wizards would even ask for from the Rockets. And again, you get into the whole issue of the Rockets would have to stack multiple salaries, so they'd have to get at least three bodies going out, Bertans coming back in. So the Wizards would have to waive a couple of their end-of-the-bench guys, or we'd potentially get a third team involved to take on a couple of those roster spots. But Bertans could easily play the backup four spot. He's not a phenomenal defender, but he comes from the Spurs, comes from a Greg Popovich system, so his defensive fundamentals are sound. Just there's, you know, physical limitations there, but as a shooter, he gives you exactly what you want in a Rockets jersey, which is a consistent above 40% three-point shooter. And in the Rockets system, he would get an absurd amount of wide-open looks. And I know that right now the main issues are defensively. You know, the Rockets are still second or third in the NBA in offense, in offensive rating. So there's not a huge need to continue to bolster your offense. But if you can grab a shooter like that, if you're not able to upgrade anywhere else, if you can't find another guy to boost the roster in some other way, then I'd say why not go for it? Because that gives you, again, a guy who is a consistent, lights-out three-point shooter to space the floor, and he could even arguably play a small ball five role. If you've got him and Westbrook on the court at the same time, there's not really a concern that he's not able to maybe box out or secure rebounds because you've got Westbrook and Harden who are not. Westbrook's a phenomenal rebounder. Harden's a decent rebounder. And as long as you focus on rebounding as a team, there's no reason that you couldn't run Bertans at the five and run a five out lineup. Bertans, PJ Tucker, some variation of that lineup, and have shooting all around the arc and consistent shooting. Because right now, again, the Rockets don't have very many consistent shooters. PJ has been pretty great all year. He occasionally has a rough game like the Pistons game. Again, he was, what was it, one of seven in the Pistons game. And then Daniel House has been pretty great all year, but has, unfortunately, ever since coming back from that illness that he was dealing with, his shooting has kind of fallen off a cliff. So hopefully he gets back into rhythm there and gets back above the 40% mark. But having a guy like Bertans would be pretty solid. And there's a world where the Rockets can actually acquire both. They could get Bertans and they could get Morris. It's all about whether or not Tillman is willing to spend. And that's been the big question surrounding Tillman Fertitta, is whether or not he's willing to spend and continuously spend to keep this team competitive. He's been willing to, or at least in theory, shell out the money for top-tier talent. He was willing to go into the luxury tax if it meant acquiring Jimmy Butler, but unfortunately that situation never panned out, and so we don't know if that's true or not. But for these kind of at-the-margin guys, for Markieff Morris, for Davis Bertans, for guys who would improve the overall rotation but not necessarily these star-type players, is he willing to spend to shore up the Rockets' rotation and increase their chances, however marginally, of being more competitive? Or is he willing to just let it all fall on the shoulders of James Harden and Russell Westbrook, and if those two aren't having phenomenal superstar-type games, well, tough luck, the Rockets are going to lose. If that's what he's okay with, if that's the product he's okay putting on the floor, then I don't see him wanting to pay the tax, and I see him eventually dodging the tax again. But I don't think that's the case. I'm hopeful that, again, with the way things are set up right now, it would be very difficult for him to get Daryl Morey to dodge the tax again. And with all that being said, I think that it means, hopefully, that with the window being relatively wide open this year, the Lakers and Bucks are still kind of clear-cut favorites, that he's willing to spend a bit to make the Rockets a bit more competitive, because they need it. They need a couple more rotation guys, or at least one more rotation guy, to really get this team to where it needs to be. Now, for the second bit of Rockets news from this Adrian Wojnarowski-Zach Lowe discussion, Woj said that this era of Rockets basketball is at stake with this season. Now, that's a very vague statement. That's very open-ended. You can make a lot of different interpretations about what that means. But before the season started, Zach Lowe made a prediction, and this was purely speculation, that he wouldn't be surprised if there were rumblings about Westbrook trade rumors and, surprisingly, Harden trade rumors at the end of this season if the Rockets don't make some noise. And probably it's probably finals or bust. I think that if they don't make the finals, it's probably a disappointing season for this team, which is unfortunate because you can appreciate basketball and you can appreciate an NBA team or any sports club for that matter based on how they compete, and you can enjoy the season as a whole. It doesn't have to be this championship or bust culture, which fans have really developed over the years. But to hear that there's potential, and again, this is coming from Zach Lowe. This isn't some no-name nobody. This is a guy who's very plugged in. And so if Woj and Lowe are talking about it, then there's a bit of significance there that if after this season, if this season doesn't pan out, that this era of Rockets basketball may come to an end. There's a little bit of stock that I'm putting into this. Now, I don't know what that means necessarily. It could just mean that D'Antoni's on the way out. It could mean that they're giving the Russell Westbrook experiment a one-year trial, and that if it doesn't work out this year, that they're going to try to ship him off in the offseason. And the scariest thought would be getting rid of James Harden, who is right in the middle of his prime. But if you look at what Oklahoma City was able to acquire for trading away Paul George and trading away Russell Westbrook, they are firmly set for the future of that franchise. They got SGA, they got a huge stockpile of picks, and they still have players that are playing competitive basketball right now. They're the seventh or eighth seed in the West, but they've got players that they're able to still trade off for more assets should they decide to. And so it's very possible that Tillman and Morey are looking at that situation and thinking, well, if we can't get it done this year with James Harden and Russell Westbrook right in the middle of both of their primes, then maybe they trade them off this summer. I feel dirty just saying it. The idea of trading James Harden is, I can't even wrap my head around it, because you never get a fair return when you trade a superstar. You look historically, you never get equal value back. Honestly, the Westbrook and Chris Paul trade was a pretty even value across the board, because Chris Paul doesn't give you as much as what Westbrook gives you, but then you throw in the draft compensation, and that was a pretty fair trade on both sides. And it still remains to be seen how that entire trade will pan out, because again, if the Rockets somehow win a championship with Russell Westbrook, it was all worth it. Doesn't matter how many draft picks you give up. You win one championship, it doesn't matter how many bad contracts you hand out. It doesn't matter how many draft picks you give out. You win the one championship, and it's all worth it. So again, I don't know how much stock I'm placing into this little bit of speculation that the Rockets era, this era of Rockets basketball with D'Antoni and Harden and now Westbrook, is coming to a close at the end of this season if things don't pan out, I think it's hard to imagine trading the best player in the NBA, because that's what he's been this year. James Harden has been the best player in the NBA, bar none. I don't care about the numbers that Giannis is putting up. I don't care about what AD is doing. I don't care about what LeBron is doing. James Harden is averaging 39 points a game. He's averaging more than a point a minute that he's on the court. That is unheard of. To think that he did 36 points per game last season and has now eclipsed that metric and has been comfortably above that number for most of this season after his bit of a rough start. And that's the thing. That's including his rough start, including James Harden's rough start and his shooting struggles to start the season. The fact that he's at 39 points a game right now and will probably be able to hold that number for most of the season is absurd to think about. And I know basketball isn't just offense, and that's the thing, is he has been a phenomenal defensive player this season too. Sure, he takes an occasional playoff, but when James is locked in on defense, he is a plus defender, and not just in the post. He can hang with his man. We've seen him shut down guys. It seems like every night he locks in for a few possessions or locks in for a portion of the game and plays phenomenal defense. James Harden has been the best player in the NBA this season. And the Rockets' record may not reflect that, unfortunately, because they've lost some close games here and there. The Spurs game, the Kings game, this Pistons game wasn't a close game, but they had no business losing this one. The Rockets' record may not reflect that to this point, but James has been the best player in the league this season. And I don't think any of you guys have any issues with me saying that, because let's face it, it's true. And it's going to suck to see him not win another MVP award, because he could have easily had 3 or even 4 by now. But that's just the NBA national media doing national media things. And maybe if we keep talking about it here in Houston, maybe if we stay loud, maybe if we stay rowdy about it, it'll happen. But I'm not going to hold my breath waiting on another James Harden MVP award. I'd rather he just shut everybody up by making it to the finals and winning a championship for the city of Houston. So I think for this Monday morning episode, this is where we leave things off. As always, thank you for tuning in. Now, if you want more content before our next show, social media is where it's all happening. I'm on there, at JT Gatlin. Of course, the show is on there, at Locked On Rockets. Past that, there's Facebook, which can be found at facebook.com/LockedOnRockets. The website, LockedOnRockets.com. And of course, our email address, LockedOnRockets@gmail.com. All of these are different ways to consume content about your Houston Rockets. You can ask me questions about the team, make suggestions for the show, place advertising inquiries. Really, it's just a way for you to let me know if there's anything that we can do to improve this experience for you, our listeners. Beyond that, if you'd be kind enough to subscribe and rate the show on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Spotify, Himalaya, wherever it is that you listen to your podcasts, if you could please subscribe and give us a 5-star review. That's how you get the benefit of episodes that show up straight to your inbox before they're published to the previously mentioned social media outlets, and then we get the benefit of looking attractive to potential advertisers and keeping this business model rolling along as the most regular podcast covering Houston Rockets basketball. Again, for this Monday, December 16th episode, this is where we break. As always, thank you so much for listening, and we hope to have you back again very, very soon right here at Locked On Rockets, your daily podcast home for everything Houston Rockets basketball.